This is the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 14th, 2017, brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and the Lascauzzo Institute. This week, we're going to be looking at a few developments that start with a question of what does it mean for a taxpayer to be in the business of farming? And actually, as generally is the problem with taxes, what does it mean for a specific tax benefit to be in the business of farming? We'll take a look at that issue. We'll also take a look at what it means to be in the business of lending money. That also turned out to be important in another tax case. So the tax court's looking at a couple of definitions. We'll also talk about the IRS's announcement late last week that they will not acquiesce in a decision that took place a year ago on a reverse 1031 exchange. And we'll also go over in the end a case about a minority shareholder that ended up having to turn over dividends he received that, even though he was not aware, was part of a program by the majority shareholders to bail out money from the company while not paying taxes. And so even as a practical matter, though he was also part, or say one of the victims of the fraud, well, he still had to give the money back. And we'll talk about why that's so. Couple of things coming up I want to remind you of, courses coming up that you might want to attend coming up in the month of August. Those of you in Indiana, we have a couple of ANA related courses. On the 22nd and 23rd, Rebecca Lee will be leading session dealing with accounting and auditing staff level three training for InCharge. So if you have staff or you are a member of that sort of staff entering into the InCharge level and want to go through 2 days worth of training as to what it means to be hitting that level and the sort of issues you want to deal with, that will be going on at the Indiana Society offices on the 22nd and 23rd. On August the 21st, Ken Heeslip will join Rebecca, and they'll be giving various sessions at the Accounting and Auditing Conference at the Rich Charles in Carmel, Indiana. Both of these courses, both the course and the conference, you can sign up at the Indiana Society of CPAs website at www.incpas.org. For those of you of a tax bent and who are in the state of Washington, I want to remind you that Don Cochran is going to be up there teaching estate and gift taxations, planning and compliance on August 24th, and on the 25th, going to be dealing with the multi-state taxation of business. So if you're in the Bellevue area, and you have an interest in those topics, be sure to visit the Washington Society website and sign up for those courses. Now let's talk about what we've got in terms of developments for the week. The first case we're going to look at is the case of Owens versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-157. The decision came down on the Thursday, August the 10th. This was a case of a taxpayer who had made a loan to a business that was handling laundry for hotels and the like, and the loan went bad, and not just slightly bad. In this particular case, the taxpayer was looking at a loss of $9.5 million down the tubes on this loan. The question, well, there were actually three questions we're going to have to answer today for the taxpayer. But fundamentally, a key question is, fine, you have a $9.5 million loss on a loan. What was the nature of that asset that you incurred the loss on? Because if, in fact, that is a capital asset, obviously, we've got a big problem unless this gentleman has a $9.5 million capital gain. So one of the key things we're going to look at is this a bad debt that occurred in the ordinary course of his trade or business? And that's going to be the key issue, because if it is, and it's not a loan that's otherwise that sort, then not a loan that's of an investment or personal nature, then we can get ordinary loss treatment, traditional write-off of bad debts. And secondly, of course, to claim a write-off, we have to show that the decrease in value took place in the year in which we claimed it. So we're also going to discuss, did this note actually become worthless in the year the taxpayer claimed it? So those are the key issues. Now, in order to answer all those questions, the tax court had to look at a number of criteria. For instance, the tax court first has to decide, is this gentleman really in the business of lending money? Because he needs to be in the business of lending money in order for us to get this ordinary deduction. So we have to start with that. The tax court notes that there are a number of tests that you apply, you consider a lot of criteria in determining if a taxpayer is in the business of lending money. That includes how many loans have they made? What time period did they make? Have they made these loans that they claim represent their business? What's the adequacy and the nature of the records they're keeping? Were the loan activities kept separate and apart from the taxpayer's other activities? Whether the taxpayer sought out this lending business, the amount of time and effort they expend on the activity, and the relationship between the taxpayer and his debtors. That last one would mean, for instance, if you happen to be loaning money to family, that suggests that maybe it's not a business of loaning money, but rather you're loaning for reasons other than primarily looking to make the profit. Now, one complicating factor we had in this case was that Mr. Owens was involved as an employee of a corporation he had interest in called Owens Financial Group, and they also made loans. So the other question is going to be, was Mr. Owens himself had a money lending activity, not whether he was involved in such activities? Well, initially, a key component is how many loans has he made? If you're in the business of lending money, you should make a lot more loans than somebody who is not and is doing it just casually or picks up one for a special deal. So if he made one loan in, 5 years ago, to an entity and it goes bad, well, that probably looks more like you're not in the trader business, and this is going to probably be a capital loss asset. It looks more like an investment. But in this case, he had made at least 66 loans from his personally to a large number of borrowers. They exceeded $24 million. This is just in the period from 1999 to 2013. The tax court said, well, this is more than sufficient compared to what we've said represented a trader business of owning money in a number of other cases. And they cite a number of other cases and various other fact patterns that they did this. And in 2003 from 2008, he made 33 loans totaling over $21 million, including $17 million in loans to this laundry business. That's going to be an issue. Well, the IRS complained, well, wait, well and good. But in fact, all the records were being kept by the staff of that OFG, the corporation, OFG. And because of that, doesn't that really mean that it's really just the company loans? There was no difference in these. The tax court actually said, no, that's not relevant. It's clear it was his money. And in fact, the mere fact that he kept detailed records and had people keep records for him, the employees of OSG, that kept it in detail that they did when running what was clearly a money lending business, actually, it comes in his favor. He is keeping detailed records of a type you keep when you're in the business of loaning money. So the court found that that worked in his favor. The IRS also didn't like that he didn't have a detailed accounting of how much time he spent. Now, as we've discussed before, when discussing somebody qualifying as a real estate professional or trying to prove that they materially participate in activity, not having good records of time is fatal, right? We just lose the case in that matter. But in this case, the court is less picky in this area and actually points out over the years they've been less picky. They said, keeping down your hours down to a tenth of an hour as to how much you spent on these specific loans is simply not going to be something that the average lender would spend tons of time doing. Rather, they're saying, looking at the totality of the facts in this case, we find that, he recently had to spend significant time dealing with all these loans he was making. So that holds for, we believe he had sufficient time involved. Well, the IRS said, wait, but he didn't advertise for loans. He wasn't like taking out ads and, putting up signs or putting ads in papers saying, I'm ready to loan money. Come here and borrow from me. The court said, well, we recognize that and we agree he didn't advertise it. But the catch was his reputation in the community was as a lender. He was very well respected. And it was clear from the testimony of his competition and colleagues that his reputation brought borrowers both to OFG and himself personally. And it noted it wasn't unusual for borrowers to call OFG and ask to speak to Mr. Owens personally. He basically took the riskier loans and he held those himself. The less risky loans, he went to OFG, which also had money that was effectively obtained from the public. So he put the safer loans in OFG. He would take the riskier ones on himself. Turns out one of these risky loans was the laundry loan. Okay. So the IRS said, well, let's see. Well, okay, he may be generally in the trader business of borrowing money, but these particular loans, he didn't act like they were being made in a business-like manner. So he said, you know what? He's not making them in a business-like manner because he subordinated his rights to those of another lender. And he did that when the company was in financial distress, and a real lender wouldn't have done that. Well, the tax court said, don't be as quick. They found, looking at the facts of the case, in each situation, he acted reasonably. As the court said, it's easy in hindsight to argue a lender who kept lending money to a borrower who ultimately fails to repay you acted unreasonably. But we can't look at the end and then go back and say, well, that was a dumb thing to do. Rather, we try to look at things as the lender saw them at the time. And the court found that his advancing more and more money to a growing and cap-intensive business was reasonable under the circumstances. And because at the time they needed the additional funds from another lender in order to, you know, continue to operate and for him to have a chance of getting a return on capital, well, you know, it was reasonable for him to get out of the way and do it. But what if there's no bona fide debt? Okay, even if he's in a trader business owing money, if what we have here is an equity interest in the company, then he's not going to get ordinary loss. It may be worthless, but if it's worthless, it's going to be a capital loss again. Not a good thing. Well, the IRS said first, we don't think it's a bona fide debt because even though there were stated maturity dates for the loans, Mr. Owens didn't enforce those. And they're saying, you know, a real lender would have enforced them. Well, the tax court said, not necessarily. You know, a lender who sees that if he pushes the date and accelerates when they don't meet, you know, these had acceleration clauses too. If they didn't meet the date on the first loan, it would accelerate the others. Saying a lender could look at that and say, that's just going to be a cascade of defaults and I'm not going to get anything. So rather than doing that, we just renegotiate. I don't call the loans and I try to let this work out so that hopefully I'll get paid. So the court found in this case that that was not an unreasonable step. The IRS next said, well, the only real source of repayment was earnings. And if you're getting money from earnings, that must mean that you have an equity interest. But it said, you know, in essence, they argued because though, you know, that company would be able to repay only if they were able to improve their business. They don't, that's how they use a factor. As the court said, if that were true, there could only be investments in and no lending to, you know, distressed borrowers. And that's just not the case. They said, we recognize this type of debt may look very similar to equity and you got to kind of be close. But they said, you know, bottom line in this case, his ability to repay would be harmed if they fail. But as a legal matter, the advances were secured by a deed of trust on the property, and they were obligated to pay back the advances plus interest. They didn't get out of repaying if they didn't have earnings. So because of that, it's distressed debt, but it still was debt nonetheless. Well, the IRS had another objected. He received an ownership interest in the middle of this. You know, he had loaned the company money. Things weren't going real well. They negotiated an operating agreement where he would have been able to get additional interest, and he had some say in operation of the company. And then, you know, 2 years after that, he continued to advance money. The IRS said that obviously what happened was here, he took his loan and he converted it to an equity interest. And then obviously having that equity interest, the later loans were really just advances. The court didn't agree with that either. The court said, you know what? You know, first thing is, it was a year after we had an advance that he got this agreement. And it was not till 2 years later that he made additional advances. The court agreed that if the advances had been made right at the time he got an ownership interest, that could have created equity for that transfer and maybe even for the earlier ones. But the court said in this case, we don't see any correlation. Well, the IRS said, hey, but wait, equity holders get paid after other creditors. And remember that bit where he subordinated the debt? Well, obviously, when he subordinated the debt, he put the debt below other debt. That therefore must mean that he wanted to be treated, he was really an equity holder. The tax court said, while, you know, subordination does favor the IRS's view, it's not a determinative factor. And they noted that without additional financing from that other party, he would not have seen a return, right? Well, okay, but wait, doesn't subordination raise another issue? Doesn't it mean that the company was unable to obtain financing from other people? If you're totally unable to borrow money, then people who come in must be getting an equity interest. That's basically a presumption of the law. And the court said, well, that may very well be right. But the problem here is that we had to look at the situation when he made his loan. The initial loans were made at a time when it appeared he would be repaid. The fact that later it was determined to subordinate debt and let yourself be paid after that, you know, and the fact he couldn't, they, you know, maybe he couldn't retain loans. Well, really he could, as long as it was subordinated, this other company was willing to loan him money. So they're saying, yeah, under terms, it would have happened. So we're not going to reclassify it. Next, they said, well, maybe the borrower was so thinly capitalized that these were loans at the startup. Well, the court said, you know, basically, yeah, we understand that. But here's the catch. To get debt reclassified as equity due to thin capitalization, you have to show the debt to equity ratio was initially high. The party realized it would go higher, and substantial portions of the funds were used for the purchase of capital assets and for meeting expenses to commence operation. Now, what they said here was, wait, a couple things are true. Number one, some of this loan, the initial loan, was used to repay other debt. As well, he obtained security that appeared to be sufficient to cover the loans in property. So it does not appear that the company was so thinly capitalized that this had to be an equity investment. Rather, the court found that it was still a debt. So now all that remained was for the taxpayer to show the debt became worthless in the year he claimed it was, which is 2008. And the IRS said, well, wait, the borrower thought his assets were worth more than the liabilities in 2008. Court said, that's fine, but we don't see any reason to give that credence if there's no other evidence. Well, wait, the taxpayer filed a claim in the bankruptcy. Court said, well, that's not a good fact. And frankly, to be totally honest, it probably would have been better had the taxpayer not filed that claim in the bankruptcy case, since that does give some evidence you expected to be repaid at least something. But the court said, given all the other evidence, we don't see that that overwhelms everything else. So because of that, we agree we have a bona fide debt, and we also agree that it became worthless in 2008, the year in which he made the claim. So he gets a $9.5 million deduction, and he can carry it back as part of a net operating loss. Next up, we have a case where the question here becomes, was this person a farmer for a particular purpose? This is Rutkowski versus Commissioner. This is tax court decision 149 TC number 6, issued on August the 7th. What this particular ruling talks about here is there are special rules involved, as we all aware, if a taxpayer makes a donation of a qualified conservation easement. Now, that's when you basically, you don't give away the land really entirely. What you give away or what you give is you agree that changes won't be made to the property in order to have some conservation purpose served, and you give that gift to a charity that has normally as one of its, you know, one of its goals, the preservation of various environmental factors, etc. And a special rule applies if you are a qualified farmer or rancher. You can actually offset 100% of your AGI. You can take a deduction equal to 100% of AGI can be allowed as a deduction for the qualified conservation easement. In this case, the taxpayers wanted to be able to do that full offset. Our real question here is, do they get offset 100% or do they get offset 50%? Now, the question is, as we always know under tax law, whenever you see the word qualified farmer or rancher, it means it's a little more complicated than just are you a farmer or rancher. Rather, the question becomes, to be a qualified farmer or rancher, more than 50% of your gross income for the taxable year must come from the trade or business of farming. And to be involved in the trade or business of farming, you actually have to take a look at IRC Section 2032 Cap A E5, because that's the cross-reference you're going to find. And that talks about the four things are cultivating the soil or raising or harvesting any agricultural, horticultural commodity, including the raising, shearing, feeding, caring for, training, and management of animals on a farm. Second category is handling, drying, packing, grading, or storing on a farm any agricultural or horticultural commodity in its unmanufactured state, but only if the owner, tenant, or operator of the farm regularly produces more than one half of the commodity so treated, and the planting, cultivating, caring for, or cutting of trees, or the preparation other than milling of trees for market. Now, the taxpayers during this year also had, in fact, part of the conservation easement was a bargain sale transaction. So they had significant proceeds from the sale of farmland the year in question. That farmland had been used for these purposes, so they counted the proceeds from sale as part of their farming gross income. The IRS said, no, that's not one of those four activities. And the taxpayer said, well, no, what we're saying it comes from, because since it was used in that, it should count as one of those four activities, that the sales proceeds should be allowed for purposes of this calculation. The tax court in this case sided with the IRS. The court ruled that this, you know, doesn't meet those requirements. You have to, it's only income from actually cultivating the soil, from actually doing those activities. Selling land is not one of those activities. Now, the court recognized that in reality, because of this, somebody who legitimately is a qualified farmer or rancher for the last 20 years could have a problem if they sell a lot of farmland in the year in which they make the conservation easement donation. That could be the 1 year out of the 20 before and the 10 after that is the year in which they're not a qualified farmer. And the court said, that's fine, but it's not the work of the tax court to rewrite a statute. That work, of course, would belong to the United States Congress. The court's decision, essentially, Congress said only these four activities count. To us, it seems fairly plain that selling land is not one of those activities, regardless of what the land was used for. So because of that, tough luck, guys, you can only claim 50% offset of your income from the donation of a qualified conservation easement, and the rest that you claim, which probably, you know, which almost certainly wiped out their income, no, that other half of the income, you owe tax on that for this year. And by the way, the other half of the income will also obviously include the gain on sale will be part of that. So bad news for the definition of farming. Is it an unfair result? Yeah, the court indicates they understand why it might be unfair. But the court also says, go talk to your congressman. We can't help you. Next up, we want to mention that the IRS this week issued action on decision 2017-06, was issued here on August the 14th. And in that decision, they indicated they did not agree with the tax court's decision in the Bartell case. In the Bartell case, the tax court found that the benefits and burdens test did not apply to reverse 1031 exchange. If you go back just about a year, last August, because this case came down on August the 10th of 2016, you'll find that we had discussion of the Bartell case in an earlier version of this podcast. And we also have the write-up on our website that talks about that case. In that case, the taxpayer had a reverse 1031 exchange. They ran drugstores. The building was completed, and they actually started running the drugstore for a decent period of time before they were able to complete the 1031 exchange, and, you know, pick the property to sell for the reverse exchange. Remember, in a reverse exchange, we are basically acquiring the replacement property, or the intermediary is acquiring the replacement property before we dispose of the property that was going to be the gain on sale property. In this case, the tax court ruled that while benefits and burdens is often used, it's not used in this purpose to determine that they are the real owner. They said, no, as long as the formalities were followed, they're not the real owner. The IRS this week is telling you that they want to challenge that result. Now, it is a published tax court decision. So obviously, if you go back to the tax court, you're going to get the same decision. But they're telling you that they would really like to, they think now, take that up to a court of appeal. Now, interestingly enough, they did not take it up to the Ninth Circuit. My guess is, to be totally honest, the Ninth Circuit has been where lots of new law has been dredged out in the 1031 exchange area, and it's almost always been not IRS friendly. My guess is they want to challenge this, but they'd prefer to do it somewhere other than the Ninth Circuit. So they're just telling you that, hey guys, especially those of you outside the Ninth Circuit, you bring this back up, we're probably going to say no, and we're going to dare you to take us to your circuit court of appeal. So just be aware of it. Certainly it means that it's going to be very difficult to get one of these through an exam. You know, at the exam or appeals level, they basically have word from on high they are not to give in on this issue. Finally, this week, we have what's a very unfair case, but nevertheless, the case we have. This is the case of Kardash Sr. versus Commissioner. This is an appeal to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. It's case number 16-14-254. It came down on August the 4th, though it got published by Tax Analysts this week, which is where I found it and picked it up. Now, this was the case of an individual. He owned a minority interest in a construction company, right? So he basically did this. Now, the court admitted that he was a victim, along with the IRS, of, in the words of the court, a fraud conducted by his friends and co-workers at the company, and specifically the two owners who controlled the vast majority of the company's stock. What happened in this case was the company was running, and it was making money, but they weren't paying tax because the majority owners were finding ways to get cash out of the company. Now, the economy turned sort of sour, and these people still want to take their cash. So what ended up happening was that they ended up taking dividends. Now, when they took dividends, because they were dividends, they also made payments to Mr. Kardash because he was a minority shareholder. He was not aware that the goal of these dividends was to bankrupt the company so the IRS couldn't get paid. But he got those. Also, when the economy went south, that was in the last decade. Remember last decade where we had the real estate crash, so that, you know, this construction company was no longer making tons of money. He also received a number of advances. The tax court had said, because the IRS tried to get back both the advances and the dividends under a transferee liability theory. The tax court ruled that the advances really were, what he argued, payment for services. They said they were meant to replace the bonuses, and because of that, you know, the IRS couldn't grab those. That was not a fraudulent conveyance because the company got his services in exchange for the advance. But the tax court disagreed the dividends were that. And they also said, he said, but wait, it wasn't yet insolvent when the first dividends were paid. It took a while to get that out. But the court said the dividend payments were overall part of a plan. Well, he took this to the 11th Circuit, and the 11th Circuit agreed with the tax court's decision. They, as unfair as it was, he had money that should have gone to the IRS, the dividends, because, which he got without giving the company anything of value. So because of that, that entire amount he got paid, which is over $1.5 million, needed to go back to the company, to the IRS. They were able to collect that amount from him under a transferee liability theory. So they said, you know, the takeaway here is you don't necessarily have to be aware that the conveyance is bankrupting the company. as long as, in this case, obviously somebody was aware there was a plan to do it. And you may have been an innocent bystander who didn't know what was going on, but you still might have to repay it. Well, remind you, as always, again, we do these live CP courses, and that's what pays for the ability to do these, you know, these podcasts. So I want you to consider, and that's also what pays for ability for your state societies to support these podcasts, consider checking your state society's website and take a look at the courses coming up. They offer you lots of options. They offer lots of live interactive where you can ask questions of people. There's nothing quite as good, and I know from giving courses live and webcast in every way possible, that people who want to get their questions answered are just, you know, it just happens easier. So a lot easier to do that in the live setting. So check out your state society's offerings and consider signing up for their courses. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 14th. Remember, the PDF with all this week's articles is available on our website on the weekly update page. So you can go there for the audio and video updates page. You can download the article with the PDF with all this articles. By the way, that PDF also features this week a reprint of what we told you in the Kardash case initially. So you can review that whole 1031 issue, the reverse 1031 exchange case that the IRS has decided they're not going to follow. We also, during the week, post updates as things occur to our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. So you want to check there, see what's happening. And also check back in next week here, where we'll tell you what's been going on. Probably will still be a bit quiet because Congress obviously is not back in town yet. We await to see what happens when they come back to town about tax reform, and we certainly will keep you up with that here. But I'm sure we'll get something from the courts, the IRS, and other locations. So until next week, take care, and then come back and hear us next week here on Current Federal Tax Developments.